retirement system, House Bill 5040, and we are still in the budget and policy packages and the 2% efficiencies portion. Mr. Curry is here from the agency, and good morning, Paul. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Again, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. I might start with our package responding to some questions and information requests from yesterday. The first item is an indication of the specific questions that we asked in both our customer service and our employer satisfaction survey, and then the ratings across the entire spectrum. You might remember yesterday we focused on the numbers that were in the good and excellent category. You can see that at least for the employers, we got a lot in the fair category. For the customers, we got a lot in the poor category, which, you know, you would expect more to be a bell curve rather than the type of curve that we've got there. Again, I think, as we talked yesterday about employer satisfaction with employer rates, we certainly probably suffered some reaction to the benefit reductions and to the recalculations. And so while it may be difficult to move the meter in the good and excellent range, I think we definitely can move it in the poor range. We've got to separate people's rating of our service with their satisfaction with what the benefit level is, and I think we can do that, but we wanted to share that with you. The second item is our statutes on reemployment of retired members. We start with the exception to those statutes under the eligibility for retirement, and this is if you go out on a reduced benefit. In other words, you haven't worked until you're age 58 or you haven't got 30 years of service if you're a general service member, you cannot come back and work full-time. You can't qualify for any of the exceptions that allow you to work full-time, and that's more of an IRS regulation than a state regulation. You have to, if you want to come back and work full-time under any of these exceptions, you have to go out on a full benefit. You can't retire early and then come back. And the second page shows what these exemptions are, and as I discussed yesterday, they're primarily in areas of the state with low population density, school administrators and teachers in counties with less than 35,000 people, sheriff in a county with less than 75,000, municipal police department in a city with less than 15,000, state and county correctional institution employees, counties of less than 75,000. Then we've got three small service districts in the Bend area that are specifically listed, state police, counties of less than 75,000, National Guard, and so forth. So, again, the limitations or the exceptions to coming back and working full-time are primarily in areas where the legislature, I think, has determined that we've had difficulty recruiting and retaining qualified people.
But
yes, sir.
You're telling me that there's some federal thing here, and then you're telling me that I guess just a little confused.
Okay.
That we have the ability as a state to make exceptions for this, that some people can then do this.
Chair Jensen, the federal limitation is you cannot go out on an early retirement and come back and work full-time under any of these exceptions. So you have to go out on a full retirement. And that's just because of the tax-qualified nature of the plan. Yeah, they don't want people basically retiring early and then continuing to work, so you have to meet the full retirement.
But the decision to allow them to come back or not come back to work is solely
the
state
legislature. Yes, sir.
Decision.
Yes, sir.
As long as they retire full time.
As long as they are full service retirement.
So they're not adding to their retirement.
Yeah, we're not opening the door to basically people seeming to work both sides of the system. Yeah. But again, we talked yesterday about the somewhat limited nature of these exceptions, and the question was raised as to what type of benefits do people get when they come back and reemploy after being retired. My understanding, at least at the state level, if you come back as a temporary employee, you don't get any benefits. If you come back in a limited duration or what they call a status position, you'll get health insurance, but you are not PERS-covered salary. So a retired employee that or a retired member who is reemployed doesn't you don't pay PERS on top of that rate.
I am having a little bit of difficulty here too, Paul. This is probably a policy issue, not maybe a Ways and Means thing. But in the case of a legislator, only one of the exceptions that I'm personally familiar with, this doesn't hold.
Right, you fall under a different exception. You can be retired, come back, and there is PERS coverage for your additional service.
It can be, yeah.
Right.
And I could have two PERS accounts.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you could. Yeah, and I think a number of people. You've also got the option of having it directed in the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. Yeah, there's the general rule is what I'm talking about. There certainly are exceptions. Again, the legislature's got that one set.
Though it's amazing to me, as we thought about ethics this time, we didn't think about that. Go ahead.
Well, again, I just wanted to follow up on those two requests, and then we've also we've got a copy of our in our surveys. I skipped over something here, and I'll come back to it now. We included the most recent employer survey. It's entitled the MERS CSD, and that stands for our Member Employer Relations section in our Customer Service Division. And it's the response to our 2006 survey. This was a survey that was done in December of this year. The general survey was done back in the summer of this year. And you'll see here what are the main concerns that employers are having in terms of their reporting relationship with us. And the number one is eligibility issues. And this is particularly true for school districts and other people who have significant numbers of part-time employees. The requirement that folks work 600 hours a year in order to be eligible for PERS, but they can accumulate that 600 hours with multiple employers, can be a real reporting headache for those school districts. So I just included this. I'm not going to go into any detail, but I would point out that first page is really our response to these concerns, and I think you'll see that we take these to heart, and we're trying to respond in a comprehensive manner and addressing it through a number of different activities. Again, the three things that we primarily control: people, process, and technology. What can we do in all three of those areas to respond to these customer service concerns? And then the final item is just the cover of it is the cover sheet for that benchmarking study that we contract with every year, and it's called Defined Benefit Administration Benchmarking Analysis, Oregon PERS. You'll see the summary is the first sheet, where we sit in terms of how our administrative costs compare to our peers, how many transactions we do. You can see we've got a real high transaction volume. Some of this is because of the 44,000, 45,000 accounts that we're having to recalculate. Those are new transactions that other systems aren't going through. So we've got a lot there. You know, we talked about our service score below the peer median. Those are things that we talked about yesterday and today in terms of what we're trying to address there. The term they use, relative complexity, you know, we're a multi-tiered, multifaceted system. We've got four different programs. That's somewhat unusual, and that lends us to being, at least in their terminology, a relatively complex system. You can see our peers are a little bit larger than we are, so they've got some economies of scale that we don't gain, but the average for our active and annuitants are your retirees, we're covering about $268,000, and our peer median is about $321,000. Similar cost environment. And from a total cost standpoint, they say they're close to what we would predict after we adjust for the differences in those economies of scales, transaction volumes, and the cost environment. We talked yesterday about the main benefit of this report, at least in my opinion, is how we compare on an activity cost basis. The second page just shows our cost and our volume, and then cost per unit for each of those types of activities. The third page shows how we compare to our peers in each of those activities, and you can see where we're better and where we're worse. One of the areas that we do pretty well in, and we talked about the amount of pension dollars that we put out into the economy every year, we do pretty well in just maintaining low costs associated with actually paying the pensions out. Pension inceptions, we're a higher cost system there, and we talked about the fact that we're having to do a lot of things with our desktop applications rather than a main system application. We expect that to go down with the RIMS conversion project. Some of the other areas where we're certainly higher, the service to employers, again, that's a function of our moving to this electronic data exchange and being in the first couple of years of that process. We expect those dollars to come back in line with our peers as well. Disabilities, some of the peers that we're compared to use just the Social Security designation of a disability. If you go to Social Security and get Social Security to declare that you're disabled, the state will then accept that for their process as well. We use a separate review process. We've got different standards than Social Security, so we've got some additional costs there. We've got some independent medical reviews in other areas that some of the other systems that don't use. But in general, you know, you can see where we've got opportunity to improve and actually where we're somewhat a leader in things as well. Fourth page is the numbers that I was telling you yesterday. This is those costs then adjusted for our volume. And again, we're a high volume agency. And you can see the peer median is about 117. This is cost per active member and annuitant. So this does not include the inactive members. In our system, the inactive members still receive annual statements, still receive services from us, and because we're an account-based system as much as we are a service time-based system, we've got some unique costs there. But you can see where we sit. The peers are in the blue lines, we're the black line, and all the systems that report in this benchmarking analysis are in the gray. And then just an explanation of the transaction type. This full detailed report, again, is this large one. We sent a PDF on this to Dallas, and be happy to, if you'd like, it's your pleasure to sit down with you and go through some of the specific activity areas.
We have forwarded that. Mr. Chair, we were going to forward that to all of the members. It may have gotten to you yesterday.
A lot of good ideas in there. We also get from this entity best practices analysis. They've done a best practice analysis on member statements. They're doing one this year on call centers. We can learn from what other systems are doing, how they're succeeding in improving their service, and again, in some areas, we actually are a leader as well. Okay. So with that, I might then go back into the presentation notebook and go under tab 5. That's the one we started with yesterday, and again, we're now into the summary of the governor's recommended budget, our policy option packages, and our 2% efficiencies.
What tab is it?
Under
tab 5.
Page 35.
Yeah, start on page 35 under tab 5. Bates, we've got a copy of the presentation there. You can use that to follow along.
Thank you.
We're on page 35 then of that document. The governor's recommended budget for PERS totals about $6.4 billion. That includes our benefit payments, our debt service, and our general agency obligations. From a total budget standpoint, we're the third largest budget in Oregon state government, behind Department of Human Services and the Education Department. Our operating budget, however, is only a small portion of that, and on an annual basis, it would total about $41 million over the biennium per year. That equals about 7 basis points compared to our $61 billion PERS fund, down from about 8 basis points. You might recall in the overview I talked about the overall administrative and investment management costs for this fund being somewhere around 40 basis points. And, you know, you might have seen in the newspaper yesterday they were talking about the average for a number of different mutual funds, 401ks, being upwards of 120 to 140. So overall, a very efficient way to deliver retirement benefits in this plan. We've got 403 positions requested. That represents a decline from the peak of 420 in 2003-2005. Had it not been for the Strunk Eugene project, we'd probably be down another 40-45 positions from that. However, and we recognize this, the governor's recommended budget does represent a budget increase over last year's of about 8.2%, $6.3 million. Factors contributing to that are the full implementation of the Strunk Eugene project, as well as the OPSERV pension and IAP programs. We use the term we re-baselined the RIMS conversion project. That means we adjusted the schedule for the RIMS conversion project to match up with the fact that we need RIMS to stay around until we complete the Strunk Eugene project, because of that, some of the costs that we would have incurred this biennium are moved into the 07-09 biennium. And then, of course, like anyone else, we've seen some increasing service charges, inflation, wage, and benefit costs. We've got 6 policy option packages. Two of them focused on the continuation of our priority projects, Strunk Eugene and RIMS conversion, and the rest focused on just the stability and continuity of our core operations. We don't have any new programs or new projects in this budget. We have a total of 139 positions requested, 8 new, and 131 are existing that we're requesting to continue into the next biennium. Of those positions requested, 37 of the 139, 37 are requested on a permanent basis, 102 on a limited duration basis. What we tried to do was identify what our core operation needs were long term and then assign permanent positions in those areas. And then the vast majority of our position requests are limited durations because we've got both the special projects that we're completing as well as the expectation that the implementation of the new technology tools, such as the completion of the RIMS conversion project, as well as our other business process improvements, are going to create efficiency gains over the next two bienniums, and we're keeping these positions on a limited duration basis because we don't anticipate that all of them are going to be around on a permanent basis. We know, for example, that the Strunke Gene project is going to be substantially complete in the upcoming biennium, and almost every one of those positions is going to disappear then, as a result of that. You can see our budget and staffing on page 37 history. We're not going to go back to 0103 because unless we go back to the old system. We're a new system. We're running four programs rather than two, but we don't anticipate maintaining this level, and I can tell you my board doesn't anticipate maintaining this level long term either. We do expect it to continue to decline. Page 38, you can see kind of how we've come down in total positions, but we're coming up slightly in the number of permanent position requests over the last three bienniums. Page 39 is just a pie chart showing where our dollars go, and like most service-based state agencies, our primary expenditures are in our people, salary and wages, and OPE benefits. We do have a substantial amount of money going into our contracted IT services. That's our RIMS conversion project. We spend a lot of money in other contracts. That's our actuarial contracts, and then some other services. We spend a lot of money in legal services. We talked yesterday about the 23 lawsuits that we've still got active and some 50 or 60 contested cases. And we spend a lot of money on data processing because that's what we are. We're a data-based agency. That's a charge to DAS for the mainframe use. And then the rest are small amounts. Sir?
We can expect in the future that these contracted IT services will go down.
Yes, yes, sir. Yeah.
We can expect the data processing to continue at somewhat.
Yeah, you might see it even increase somewhat because I think those charges tend to inflate over time.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That the contracted IT services is, a large percent of that is our RIMS conversion project, and we're $13 million, I believe, in requests this biennium. And we're halfway through that project, so you would expect in the next biennium that to almost disappear. Yeah. Position count-wise, I'm on page 40 here. Again, 403 positions total. We'd have 301 permanent, 102 limited duration. You can see how they're spread among our divisions. I would point out that of the eight new positions that we're requesting, five of them would be located in the customer service division, two of them in the benefit payment division, again, reflecting those being our core operational divisions, and one in our information services division. I'd now go into our policy option packages, starting on page 41. For those who are interested, Appendix G, or you might just make a note, Appendix G is where we show the direct connection to the performance measures. One of the requirements of the budget presentation was tying your POPs to your performance measures. This is our Strunke Gene project, 57 positions, all limited duration, a total of about $6.3 million. This is the project that involves adjusting the 1999 earnings crediting. Again, this biennium, we completed the work on the active members and inactive members, about 100,000 accounts. We made those adjustments. Now we have to go back through and recalculate benefits for about 45,000 retirees and benefit recipients. We expect it to be substantially complete by the end of this biennium. positions cross all the division lines, and you can see some of the activities that they're involved in. We're using RIMS as the book of record. RIMS goes away in November of 2009. This work's got to be completed, and that's why we're asking for this this level of commitment to that. And this is one where we're using a one-touch process. We're taking care of everything that we've got with these accounts. In the past, we pushed some of the retirements out. We had a member say, well, hey, I think I'm missing 3 months of time, and we put that into a what we called our METS backlog, and we worked it at some point, and we, of course, if the member proved out that they had worked 3 months in 1976 and we didn't have that in their records, we paid them for every dime that they were due on that. With these accounts, we're going to do all that work right now. We don't want to go back in on any of these people. When they get this benefit adjustment, they're going to see it. I use the description as we're painting all four sides of the house here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
We're just having a little sidebar here about how complicated that must be, and what's your standard of proof, and how many man hours do you have if I suddenly report that I work 6 months in 1990, tell us a little bit about how you ferret out the veracity of those claims and what standard of proof you require for records. Or
right. Well, you know, first we you know, work with the member and the employer. We go back and try to find records from the employers. If the members have got records, payroll records, tax records, or so forth, where they can show that they were actually employed and paid by this employer. We compare those dollars that they reported on their, or the salary that they can show on their tax return to the salary that got reported to us. And so we do that. I can tell you that for employer records, when you start getting back 20, 30 years, it's pretty difficult. We do have Social Security records for a lot of these, and so we've got another source on wage data as well. You know, we apply the standard reasonableness. You know, we want people to get all the benefits that they have accruing to them, but we want them also, we also have to be able to withstand the audits and everything else to show that. So it's and this is one of the reasons why we're putting so much effort now into the data correction as it comes in. We don't want to go back 30 years, over 30 years worth of data, and try to correct it. We'd rather correct it every year as it comes in. So this is why we put so much emphasis on this accurate employer reporting at the front end. And it's kind of this, we're investing a lot of time and money now in hopes that somebody who's sitting here 30 years from now won't have to answer the question as to how you go back and deal with something. They say heaven's at the end, but so far it's been something else.
If I'm co-chairing this particular committee 30 years from now, this problem appears. We're in trouble.
Yeah. Come in and brush the cobwebs off.
There you go. So that's the Strunke Gene project. RIMS conversion is package 111. Here's the money that's in our IT contracted service, $13.5 million. I think about there's only about 700,000 of that or so that's in the positions. This continues again our major IT system conversion with expected completion November of 09. These limited duration positions are positions that we are dedicating full time to this project. One of the things that we have discovered or learned from talking with other retirement systems that have gone through major IT system conversions is you've got to have your business people driving the train. And so these are the people that are pulled out of our subject matter experts, pulled out of our business units. And they're the ones that are guiding this project because we don't want to deliver a system over time here that they say doesn't meet their needs. So We've got this total project is $27.5 million, we've completed phase one, or stage one, which was the House Bill 2020 and the employer reporting side of it. We're just finishing up with some enhancements on employer reporting. We're moving now into the member demographic data, the member self-service, and the benefit calculation stages of this. Package 112 is our retirement processing package, 25 positions, 23 of them limited duration. Two of them requested on a permanent basis. Those two, one of those is a new position to deal with judges. We talked yesterday about the large number of judges that are coming through the retirement pipeline, and the fact that they're on a totally different plan, and we need to have someone dedicated to working with those. We've got one person now. We've got no other redundancy. It's not something that we can put off on other staff members, and so we want to enhance our ability to serve that particular plan, the judge plan. The other permanent position request is one for training. This is an existing position that we've asked that's now LD that we've asked to move to a permanent. Again, it's training on use of the new system. This is the package that allows us to basically handle the workload that we've got. Again, we anticipate somewhere around 6,000 pension retirements, about 3,000 individual account program retirements, and somewhere around 5,000 withdrawals. These positions handle that workload. Again, the majority of these are existing positions that we're asking to continue into the next biennium. We're continuing them as limited duration, because we want to complete the RIMS conversion project and those other business process improvements and see whether long-term we actually need that number. Again, anticipating we won't need all these positions long-term. Package 113 is retirement data support. Without the data being correct and complete, the calculation is going to be in error, and it's going to be much more difficult and inefficient. So we put a lot of effort into the front end. This is focuses on collection, preparation, integrity of data necessary to calculate the benefits. Here we recognize that a number of these positions, while they're existing positions, we believe that they're core long-term positions. So you'll see we're asking for 8 of these on a limited duration position basis, but 15 on a permanent basis. And in this package also, we've got 4 new positions, 3 of them that will deal with employer separations, or member separations, and deal with the employers. Again, the critical nature of getting those separations processed in a timely manner so we can get that benefit out the door in a timely manner. And then one of the new positions is dedicated to our technical writing and documentation. I was interested in the headline article in today's Oregonian about writing in plain English. If you get a chance and you want to look at our employer response to that December survey, you'll see one of the complaints is we don't understand your guys' instructions. They're way too long. They're written in bureaucratese. We need to simplify our communications with our employers, and this position's focused on that. We think that, you know, that will pay off in both the short and the long term with the employers actually able to comply with our request. And it takes certain training to be able to write in plain English. When I first came to PERS, I was a real good judge of things that went out. I'll have to admit that after you work there 3 years, you get used to the acronyms, you get used to the explanations, and I'm not as useful in that area as I was 3 years ago. But I am a firm believer in taking the time to write things clearly and write them succinctly. And so that's what that position focuses on. Package 114 is our operations and infrastructure support. 28 positions, 8 LD, and we're requesting 20 of them on a permanent basis. Again, almost all of these are positions that we currently have. This focuses on our improvements in procurement and contracting, our human resources, our IT maintenance. The one new position that we're requesting here is a position to assist in our IT application support. Right now, when we have the contractor on site, we rely on the contractors to do a lot of the maintenance work on this new system. When they're off site, we're going to have to pick up that obligation ourselves, and that's what we're asking for in this, with that new position, as well as retaining some existing positions in the tech support area. Last package is our legal services package. This is just a request for limitation to spend up to $1 million in other fund. And again, I'm sure you all recall we're totally other fund funded agency, funded out of the investment returns on the fund. But we need limitation to expend any of those dollars. And this would allow us to retain the outside legal counsel that we've got working on our reform-related litigation, contested cases, and the fiduciary responsibilities. We talked yesterday, Chair Jensen, about the 23 cases. I asked my staff last night, I think I responded that the majority of those were reform-related, and they said, yes, they are. We expect to have to spend somewhere around $500,000 of this money on the defense in those cases. We are going to see contested cases in our Strunk Eugene calculations. As we go back and do that one touch, we know we're going to see that. And so we've got money in this package for that. We continue to work with our outside counsel on the tax qualification issues for this plan. That's one of the advantages of a plan like this. All the dollars that are going in are non-taxable. The members' dollars, the employers' dollars. The retiree pays the taxes when they come back out. When you've got a $60 billion fund, you can imagine the tax obligation on that. We want to preserve that tax-qualified nature of the plan so it doesn't fall on the state or the system to have to incur those costs. We continue to do it where the taxes are paid by the retiree when they get the benefit payments. You can see the board takes its fiduciary responsibilities extremely serious, and our target here is that we prevail on every case that involves claims that we've failed to perform our fiduciary obligations. In terms of our efficiencies and 2% reductions associated with those, what we tried to do here was identify reductions that we could absorb without impacting customer service in any dramatic fashion. And some of it is we've gotten smarter since we originally put our budget together. You know, I'm sure you understand agencies, we were putting this budget request together a year ago. And in order to get it to our board in June, I think we had to have it almost finalized by April. So we've learned some over that time period that we can do without some of the requests that we've got in our Strunk Eugene package. That first one is I think two positions in our imaging. We've gotten a lot more efficient there. We've got a couple of positions in our contributions and banking system and contracts division that we've learned how to do without. We've got those on this list. We also have a workforce management plan now in place for our Strunk Eugene project. Again, we're fully hired on that, but we know we're going to lose people over time. These people are in limited duration positions. And what we've identified are positions that if we lose it as of this date, we're not going to refill it. From that standpoint, we're able to identify some savings in that package as well. Should there be a desire on behalf of the committee to have us launch into anything that we haven't proposed in our budget that's not included in the governor's recommended budget, this is the source of funding that we would recommend you use to support those activities, and we've got those four positions in this as well that we recommend you use to support anything that we haven't requested. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I've gotten through the formal presentation. I just wrap up by again going back to, I guess, our strategic objectives, which are under tab one. No, sorry, tab three. Am I going to get into the right place here?
What page is it? Page seven.
Yeah, thank you. Page seven. You know, this. What do we exist for? These are the reasons why you've funded this agency in the past. These are what we're trying to achieve today and into the future. These are the things that we tried to tie our budget proposal to, and we try to tie our entire operations to. I believe that you know, we've seen the system put back on a sustainable basis with PERS reform. You know, we saved the system. We darn near broke the agency there for a while, but I think we've got the agency back on a path of sustainability as well. You know, you can see we've got some challenges. We certainly have got some warts in the customer service arena, but we've got commitments to address those, and I think we put together a budget that will help us achieve these objectives and the desires of both our members and employers as well. So with that, I'd be open to any questions.
Great. I have a couple quick questions, sure. And I'm no expert on PERS, and you may have covered this yesterday, but you can just stop me, okay? When I look sort of a future for you, for your agency in the next 5, 6, 7 years, a couple of things strike me, and I have these things I put in my budget notes that are sort of my oh shit notes, you know?
Yeah.
And one of them for you is when I look at what your population served looks like age wise. You would expect, you know, I mean, the average person comes in at 25 and retires at 55, gives 30 years of service. Your bell-shaped curve should be somewhere around 40, 45 years of age. But your bell-shaped curve appears to be about 55 to 58, just about the time everyone's getting out. So you've got, I would assume you have a big workload you're going to have to deal with the next few years of getting those benefits out, figuring out what they are, get those people retired. But I would hope at that point, 4 or 5 years now, that curve will shift back to something in the middle, and your workload hopefully will go down. Do you see that as something that might occur in the next 4 or 5 years, or are you looking at a continued workload that just doesn't seem to end as far as retirement is concerned?
Chair Jensen, Senator Bates, yesterday we talked some about how our workload doesn't necessarily end with the processing of the retirement. It's something that we're becoming increasingly aware of. We touch retirees much more, many more times per year than we touch our active members because of the benefit payments that we're making, the need for them to keep up to date on their withholdings and their address changes. But we certainly have a lot of work involved in processing retirements. If we can work our way through this 50,000 people that are eligible to retire in the next five to 10 years, one of the things we're seeing now with PERS reform, as well as the rising health insurance costs, people aren't retiring as early as they used to. They seem to be pushing our average retirement age is starting to increase. And we probably pre-purchased a number of retirements right in 2003 when people tried to get out the door before some of the reform. But we know we've got 50,000 people eligible. We got to be prepared to handle those. We'd love to have them come out 6,000 a year, but if they come out 10,000, you know, we've got to be able to handle that. Down the road, you'll see. I think the bottom of that curve, I'm looking on page 8, is our OPSR population, and these are people who have been hired since July 1 of 2003. And you actually see we've got a number of them in the higher age group as well. It's interesting. I think the average age for an OPSR member is somewhere around 40 years old. We're seeing a number of second career people come back into government. So we still could be processing a large number of retirements just because they become age eligible, not service eligible. This wave, though, is the thing that concerns us. It's a tsunami coming at us. We'd like to see it back a little bit further, but this is our lot. It's coming right at us.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I just see that as your biggest concern.
Oh, yeah.
Down the line.
Yeah.
Everything is right there. It's,
yeah.
And I think it's more than just baby boomers. You've got a wave coming at you. It's not just baby boomers. It looks like the workforce has just aged.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think things changed back in the 80s, and public service became better paid, better benefits, and people didn't move in and out like you would expect them to. They just stayed. So I think it's bulge moved through. I mean, certainly in my area of the state, that's the case. The best jobs in my area of the state are public service jobs.
Right. We've seen some of that. It's interesting. You would think that the majority of our people are 30-year people. They're not. I think our retirements, about 15 to 17% of them are 30-year people. Our average is only about 20 years that they'll be in the system because people come in and out. You know, I'm an example. I've discovered that 19 and 11 doesn't equal 30. You know, I've got 19 years in Wyoming's retirement systems and 11 in Oregon, but it's not 30 in either one of them. And there are people that move around in different occupations. But it's and we also, in our own agency, we are seeing a number of people coming back into government as second careers. Perhaps it's because of the limited duration positions that we're offering. A lot of them are just interested in working a couple of years and, you know, they're working their way back down the career ladder, if you will, rather than up it.
I think it drives what you're trying
to
do.
Yeah, it drives. It does. And I think you'll see our RIMS conversion project, our three policy option packages focused on our core operations, those are all aimed at enabling us to handle this wave as it comes at us.
That people working back down the career ladder, I know the feeling on that. But the question I have for you is, given my counseling session here this morning, and given my steps that I've taken working down, what's my next step after down the career ladder? I got to go to work for an agency.
You got
to
wait.
I'm going to make big money because the other private sector.
I was just taking a step.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Appreciate the work here.
Mr.
Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to just make a comment, and that's with regards to the IT project and the J-Clarity and the RIMS conversion. 2 years ago, the IT structure for PERS was yet once again in a whole lot of trouble just because we kept pouring money into a system that was never going to recover and kept trying to revive RIMS, and it just was not going to happen. We finally made, I think, the good decision to say, you know, we're going to cut our losses, we're going to get out of that thing, and we're going to tell the agency, get a system that will work. JClarity is a modular system, so consequently, if a part of it, as it ages, needs to be replaced, it can be replaced, and the whole system doesn't have to be replaced. Information Management Committee from the 05 session, and then through JLCIMT during the interim, we've kept a very close eye, and also through JLAC, we've kept a very close eye on this project and keeping it moving. And the agency has done a very good job working with DAS, IRMD. Now Enterprise Information Systems, something or other. And they have done a very good job of continuing this RIMS conversion and the project down the track while still the agency trying to do all of the work that it needs to do from a standpoint of processing retirement requests and answering questions and all of those sorts of things. And I want to commend the agency for doing that. And I also think that, you know, I know we don't want to break our arms patting ourselves on the back, but I think it was a very wise decision that this legislature made a couple of years ago to abandon trying to band-aid RIMS and move towards a system that's going to better meet the business needs of the agency, which of course meets the business needs, or not the business needs, but the personal needs of the retirees. And I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. I guess that concludes our presentation on FERS then.
I'll sit right back here if you want to call me up again.
Very happy to. I think we have, at this point then, we're going to open a public hearing on the public employee retirement system. And we have two people currently signed up, Pat West, I think, first. And do you want to come up at the same time? Or okay. And Mary Botkins. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm the former president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I've actually been retired. I'm a retired member of PERS now for over 5 years, which seems astounding to me. The time has passed really quick. And part of the reason I'm here is I'm here representing the PERS Coalition, which is, as you know, is a large conglomerate of people that all have one thing in common, and that is that they're PERS members. The lion's share certainly are represented by labor unions, but there's management people that are members of the PERS Coalition. There's staff people from the universities, corrections officers, police officers, firefighters, and all fashions of workers. And the one thing they do have in common is that one day they walk out the door here at PERS. I'd like to back up just a little bit and also say that I think that Director Paul Cleary has done a fantastic job. He was dealt a hand of cards that was really, really difficult to hold on to. I think he's done a great job, and all the employees of PERS are working really dutifully and hard to accomplish the goals of the PERS system. And there are a few things that generally speaking, I'm in favor of the PERS budget, and with one exception, and that is our request here. When I retired in 2001, I actually got to sit down with a counselor. An individual that knew the system, knew the options, understood how to describe them and the implications that they would have on the individual. When you retire, you're making decisions that deal with you, that deal with your life, your situation, and it's one of the most difficult things that you do, and I can attest to it. I mean, it was even though I've dealt with PERS for a long time, when I walked in the room and sat down and we're talking about pretty much decisions that are final. Now, they may not be totally irrevocable, but certainly as soon as you leave employment, going back to work is. And most of the decisions you make within a few months, they're set in stone. as far as the option that you took at retirement. So sitting down with a counselor makes you decide things and discuss things such as the health of your spouse, the health of yourself. And this sounds like things that you don't really want to talk about, but the fact of the matter is you're making a financial decision that all of these things have a bearing on, because you may decide that you may walk into the room thinking that, you know, you don't need a survivorship benefit for your spouse. But after you sit with the counselor and understand the complications and what it means and the calculations for your spouse to receive a 50% or 100% survivorship benefit, you end up with a reduced benefit for life, but that benefit then continues in some fashion for your spouse. So these are heavy decisions, and I'm, as you know, I'm not really following my testimony here, but it's all going to get touched on. The other decision that's been referred to is that when you buy a house is probably the second biggest decision, that a financial decision that the average person makes. And as you know, there's regulations that, you know, you essentially have a third party that administers the actual transaction. They're there telling you what the laws are, what the interest rate is, how long a term it is, and then they have you sign, as you know, a stack of papers that's about this high that it describes to you in detail what each of those decisions is and what it means. Well, right now, first retirees, they receive a printout. They have it where it shows all these options. They get to go to a group counseling session. But most people in a group counseling session don't really feel comfortable standing up and saying, oh, by the way, this is my situation. How does this impact me if I do this? And so we've ended up with a lot of members that go out on retirement that aren't really sure of the decision that they made, don't really know the impact that the option that they took was, and they're calling me. They're calling other members. They're asking them for...
They're calling
now. Speaking of calling.
So
I have no idea.
Oh, that's mine. I apologize.
It's all right. So there's probably a PERS member, I'm sure.
You want to get there?
Yeah. We're not in the moods here.
Tell him Pat's a little busy right now.
Sometimes you owe your retirement from PERS based on your service disability is not enough to make a phone call about, okay?
I have a sneaking suspicion that just made the signy die tape.
So anyway, we are here, you know, requesting your assistance, and that is to add back in to the PERS budget the positions of the retirement application assistant. And what I've attached to the sheet that I submitted, we asked PERS for some information. If you look at the back sheet, I can't hardly read it. So what I did is I blew it up. That's the sheet that's in front of it, and it's just showing the top portion of the back sheet that essentially talks about the positions as they were in pre-2001. And it showed that there was two positions in Salem, four in Tigard, and then what they called a circuit rider position. And the numbers are, these numbers, the 07, 09 biennium and 09, 11 biennium are essentially the numbers just taken. If you took what those counselors were in 01, they came up with these costs. And then verbally, our request asks for three additional circuit rider positions, and the reason is that, as you know, we now have prisons in Pendleton. We have services that are being spread out across the state, so that there's more of a need to have people to be able to talk to a counselor, or in this case, a retirement specialist, out in some of the other areas where they'd be more accessible. So that was our request, and again, our numbers aren't hard and fast, but we think that this is a good point to start the discussion and see if there isn't a possibility to get some counselors added that would help people when they walk out the door for retirement. If you look at some of the stuff that Dr. Cleary said, the numbers of retirees look very similar. 01, you had 5,000, and in 06, it's 5,500. So they had seven positions at that time. And so I think that the positions 7 to 10 is probably realistic for the number of positions that would be necessary to do these sessions. Mary?
Go ahead with Mary, and then we'll get back to questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today for the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I'm a member of the PERS Coalition, and Pat has done a great job. I have very little to add to what he's already said, other than we're here to support the addition of some, retirement application assistants or counselors.
Like
Well, no, we have to call it something
like
different now. We've retitled them, and I don't want to ask for the wrong thing.
Okay.
And so, but having said that, I wish Pendleton was the prison which is the most remote. It is not. Lakeview is our most remote prison, and it is probably the system. I mean, it's going to be the prison. Excuse me?
Is that Morgan?
It takes you a really, really long time to drive there. I can tell you that from personal experience.
Halfway across the state when you get there.
Yeah.
John?
And
you're 100 feet from the Nevada border.
You know, but I think, I mean, when you look at the makeup of the corrections department, since we've had counselors on staff, we have expanded our corrections department, I mean, immensely, and we've placed people in very remote districts. Lakeview and Ontario probably are two most remote. Ontario, I remind everybody, is on a different time zone. So they have a double problem in that they can't even call PERS, you know, in the beginning and the end of the day. And if they can find somebody to answer a question, it's usually somebody like Pat or I. And I tell our members regularly, if they could see the condition of my 401k, I would be the last person they would ever call for investment advice or retirement advice. Of the PERS Coalition, I'm one of the few that is not a member of PERS, never have been. And so, you know, I struggle every day to keep up, to give our members just basic good advice about who to talk to. And Steve Delaney can tell you that more often than not, I send them to him. And that's not a very good response when we have 22,000 members of our own. And the system, folks are struggling with trying to make, as Pat said, very good decisions. And every day I talk to people, or at least once a week I talk to people who have made bad decisions. And they've made bad decisions because they've not anticipated the cost that their health care was going to run them. They didn't anticipate other costs that they just didn't think about. And we did not have those kinds of calls when we had counselors. It's not that we never got a call like that, but we didn't have the volume that we have now. And I always go back to the three corrections officers that showed up at a PERS board meeting, and the three of them had taken the advice of what I considered to be a shyster, who encouraged them to take a double lump sum and give them his money. Let him invest it for them. And within a year, the three of them had lost most of their investment and needed to go back to work but could not buy their way back in because they had to pay back past monies and the money that they withdrew. It's a nightmare. And those are the things that we're trying to avoid, and those are the things that we think counselors will help people avoid, making poor decisions. You know, I always tell people to keep your money with PERS, whether you know, there's nobody out there that can turn the kind of investment returns that the Oregon Investment Council does. So, you know, it's those kinds of horror stories that we try to avoid, and we think that counselors will help do that. They're not going to stop everything. They're not going to stop every bad decision. And people who make bad decisions after getting good advice have to live with those decisions. But people who don't get any advice and make bad decisions are being forced to live with them too. And so we just encourage you to fund the counselor positions at a higher level and give us the circuit rider positions that we need in acknowledgement of the fact that we have a lot of public employees living in rural Oregon that don't have access to Salem and Portland offices. So thank you.
Chair would like to first apologize to the good folks from Southern Oregon.
Very Southern Oregon.
The Senator from Southern Oregon for his comment. He fully recognizes where Lakeview is and appreciates the problems that folks there have with their distance from the state capital and from a variety of the other services that are available in the state.
It was taken in the way it was intended as a joke, sir.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
And
we are also some benefit things apart from Salem, too, you know.
Yeah. with that, I have a number of questions, and I put Representative Crummell on hold first, and then we'll go to Senator Whitson and then Senator Johnson and then Senator Bates. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify two things. One is you're suggesting 7 total new positions. Am I correct in that? And 4 of those would be counseling positions and that are in an office, and the other 3 would be circuit riders, and I assume that the circuit riders would be going to the remote areas of the state to help people, give people advice and to help them through this application process for their retirement. Am I correct in that?
You're correct, except for we're actually requesting 10 positions. 7 existing positions, let me rephrase that, 7 positions that were in the budget in 2001 and the additional 3 circuit rider positions.
Okay. And then 3 circuit
and Senator, or excuse me, Representative Crummell, I don't know exactly what the workload is. We were trying to figure out, you know, what so that it would function, and we don't want to end up with more positions that are necessary. But by the same token, if we're going to implement a program, it needs to function. So, honestly, PERS is probably better people to ask as to what numbers they need in order to actually accomplish what we're trying to do here.
Okay. And that was then my next question, Mr. Chair, was...
Follow-up.
Thank you. Is to Paul and Steve and Paul, whoever else you want to have come up, the numbers, and this may be the first time that you've seen these, Paul, but are the numbers that are being reflected here fairly accurate from a standpoint of what the total cost would be, or would it actually be a higher cost? And also... from this page, is it the $2 million total at the bottom, $2 million total at the bottom, $2.5 million, or is it the $1.4 million at the top that is more reflective of what the actual cost would be? And if you want to look at that and get back to us,
actually,
I might want to look it over some.
We can perhaps deal with that question in work session.
Yeah.
When we get there, because that takes a little more of an examination.
And that's fine with me, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get the question out there.
So that'll take you off the hook for right now.
In terms of the numbers, if you don't mind, I might just say I was asked staff about the history of what was previously termed retirement counselors, and we're trying to get away from that term. We're actually going to benefit specialists in our new classification system. But these people were people that provided what we term application assistance, and it used to be these 1-hour individual sessions. We have kind of replaced some of that with our increased group presentations and some of it with our call center, but it's still, we find this gap. What do members want? Members want application assistance and validation of their understanding of these options. The options are all actuarially equivalent. Doesn't cost the system any more whether you pick option 1 or option 3 or whatever, but if you if you don't understand that if you want to provide a survivorship benefit, you've got to select one of the options that provide that. If you've got health issues or your spouse has health issues, you may want to take that into account in the selection of these options. You know, the cost is all the same to the system, but there are individual circumstances. So they want validation of their understanding of those options. And they also want to resolve any member account and employment data disputes. They'd like to resolve them up front, and we'd like to resolve them up front. You know, we know we've got retirement forms that aren't the easiest to understand. We know that we've got a checklist that we provide people, and sometimes they'll skip over a form, and that slows down the processing. They want to make sure they've done everything necessary to not impede the process. Again, we don't want to have people going 92 days without some form of income. And then they want to discuss and resolve those issues surrounding their accounts. I would say...
Let's get on with the other questions.
Okay.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. First, a clarification, Mr. Chair. It's approximately the same distance from Salem to Lakeview as it is from Lakeview to Salem.
Yes. Well, it depends how you go, though.
I've observed a similar sort of thing in my part of the state. I've checked it now for 10 years. I made that trip a number of times, and darn it, it comes out about the same.
True.
Yeah.
I guess I have a little bit of a philosophical problem with this request, in that in the private sector, when we retire, we hire a consultant to hopefully give us good advice so that we don't make poor choices. And I'm not certain why the state should be providing this service to public employees and not to other folks who are retiring across the state.
Go ahead, Mr. Webb.
Yeah. Senator Whitson, the reason is because we are members of the PERS system. PERS has decided that you have these essentially seven different options within spinoffs and or survivorships, and you can end up with 20-some different options that you can choose. We're not asking for PERS to give us advice on how it fits us. We're asking only for them to tell us what that option provides and under what circumstances. And so a private sector counselor wouldn't actually have the knowledge to actually tell us what the benefits under PERS were.
Follow up.
Cottage industries tend to spring up where they're needed, Mr. West. It's also somewhat confusing if you're planning to sell a veterinary practice, sell a farm, whatever, there's a lot of options. There's always a lot of options. And for anyone who is contemplating retiring, it is wise to hire a professional to help you avoid pitfalls that you didn't foresee.
Senator Bates.
Just on the same topic real quickly, I think you'd find that in corporations, private corporations of this size, they do have counselors available to you. You talk to Nike or Intel or Fred Meyer. When they have these many employees and complex plans, they usually do supply. I'm the same boat that you are as an individual looking at retirement someday in the far distant future. I'm going to have to hire somebody to help me out. And that's one of the things I decided to do when I decided to be independent, not work old door for Kaiser or one of the big health industries. So I think you're probably functioning at about the same level as any large corporation does, would be my guess. I'm not an expert in this, but I would guess that's about the way I've heard about it from other people. That, Claire, is that about, am I correct?
Chair Jensen, Senator Bates, yes, that would be. All we would be doing is explaining plan features. We would not be providing financial counseling. We'd not be providing tax advice. We'd not provide legal advice. We wouldn't provide estate planning. All of those things are available in the private sector, much more appropriately provided in the private sector, outside of our area of expertise and our jurisdiction, to be honest with you, and areas where I think we perhaps strayed in the past into some of those areas, which I believe triggered some of the concerns back in 2001 that cause the legislature to say, you guys are starting to operate outside of your box. We're going to restrict you back into this. I think the services that people are asking for are services we're currently providing over the phone, services we're trying to provide in group sessions. We still have a gap there. We still have a need to actually have people able to come in with their estimate, with their form completed, and say, have I interpreted this correctly? And, you know, a concern I've got, and, you know, I've worked in regulatory agencies. We used to go out, kick the dirt with people, sit down at their kitchen table, and help them fill out applications, because what we learned was the more work we put into getting a corrected application in, the easier it was for us to process that application in a timely manner. I think with the changes that we've had in place since 2001, I'm not sure that going back to the 2001 model is the appropriate model. It might be that what we need to do is do some type of a pilot project around, you know, the positions we've identified in our efficiency gains that we can give up, those four positions, enhance the ability when we go out and do group presentations in Lakeview, in Ontario, in Pendleton, we spend some additional time then the next morning, that afternoon, having appointments with people to come in and go through their application forms. I'm concerned we had a policeman out of LeGrand. We've got a contested case with him. He asked to make a purchase. He asked for information on making a purchase. We sent him the information. He didn't understand that he had to have the purchase completed before his effective retirement date. And, you know, I don't know how many policemen have retired out of LeGrand recently, but it's possibly a small police force. And if you haven't had somebody in the last 3 years, you wouldn't have somebody on staff that you could go to and say, hey, how'd you do this? We want people to do it right. We know we're providing this assistance right now, perhaps not in the most efficient manner. I don't think we go back to the old model because we've got some new tools in place, but we probably do need to enhance what we're doing just to make it easier for us to get these benefits processed properly.
Well, yes, that could.
Follow up.
Have you had a chance to down and talk us over as a work group and try to come up with a consensus plan?
You know, we've heard about this. We really haven't. I think I've talked some with, not Pat, but with Bob Livingston when I saw him a couple of days ago, and said, you know, perhaps we've got some approaches here, and we wanted to sit down and talk with our budget analysts as well about how we might be able to come up with a consensus plan and fund it within the governor's recommended budget.
Senator Johnson.
I apologize for having to step out for a constituent for just a second, so maybe you touched this, but if you do form a work group, how about a train-the-trainers kind of thing? I could see this clearly being a member benefit that AFSCME could give to their members, or your council could give, or your former council could give to their members, and maybe you train up pockets of expertise inside members of the PERS coalition so that they have a direct pipeline into the agency, but you offer it as a member benefit so that you have expertise. And if you get one that just stumps you guys, you'd have a direct pipeline back into Paul's shop to say, this one's over our pay grade, but offer it as a member benefit.
I'll tell you, again, Pat West. Senator, the problem with our organization, Oregon State Firefighters, we don't really have any office staff. We have one office manager, and we're a bunch of firefighters. So we really don't have the ability to do that. And there's smaller organizations than ours that are involved in this. Certainly there's bigger ones. There's AFSCME, there's SEIU, you know, and the OEA. But the fact is, we would really like it to be uniform. We would like it to be that they all get the same information, they get the same options, they get the same opportunity when they go through PERS to initiate their retirement. And to answer your question, Senator Bates, I was trying to come up with a number, you know, that would work. I certainly think that if PERS thinks that they can come up with a pilot project that dovetails with programs that are in existence now that weren't in existence in 01, then we're certainly in favor of trying to make that work.
Mr. Chair, could we suggest that you sit down for the next 4 or 5 days and come back to this committee if the chair thinks it's appropriate and lay out for us what you think might be something that would work for all parties here? It sounds to me, when I look at your key performance measures, there are some gaps. I see you've moved to 95% as far as processing in 30 days, but customer satisfaction still seems to be pretty low. You're a good person. You're doing a great job with the agency. You people are a legitimate concern. Let's get together and see if we can come up with a consensus. I think what Senator Johnson's offered may be part of that picture. I think it's a pretty good idea. Put it in the mix and see what you come up with in a week.
Be happy to.
Chair, is that appropriate?
I think that's fine. I think maybe, the good Lord willing, we can make that kind of fit into the first of the work session sort of thing, so that and they may be able to bounce this off of some of the representatives and with LFO before we come in to the work session on this, so we'd have a little better grasp of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to Senator Johnson's suggestion.
Make it very good, because the chair was going to follow on that.
Okay. Then maybe I should just wait till the chair asks his question.
No, but go ahead.
Senator Johnson, I have since, for longer than I want to think about it, I have been going out and doing PERS presentations in work sites and lunch meetings and after hours meetings with our members, and it is a challenging experience, and I can't think of anybody who currently works in our organization, and we have about 40 staff people in our organization, who is willing to pick up the ball. They are all so glad that somebody on staff has some knowledge of PERS that they aren't willing to learn it. And I do think that there is a point where you sort of cross the line when people are asking you, should I retire? Can I do this? What's my retirement going to look like if I do this? That we can't answer because you just don't have the knowledge, the expertise, the background that the PERS staff has with this. And it's such a complicated, unique system that it's really challenging.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I'm suggesting that you could develop that expertise. The PERS guys had to learn it at some point in time, and granted, they sit in the office and it probably oozes through the walls by osmosis, and they get smarter just for hanging out there. But I would submit to you that if you trained people to be possessed of that expertise, that they would be just as knowledgeable as anybody Paul would have. And eventually that becomes their specialty, is advising members. And I would see it as a very desirable member benefit, unique to some of the people that you represent, county folks that would have a different smack scenario than state people. I'm making this up because I obviously don't have the expertise, but just suggesting that it might be a highly desirable member benefit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that may be that if I look like a deer in the headlights solely because it's like, oh my God.
It would never be Mary by choice.
But I do think, I think what you're suggesting is an interesting idea, and certainly not one that I'm talking out of hand.
As a former dues paying member of one of the organizations, I think I have and I know they don't want to come up and get involved in that. That wasn't the organization.
No, it wasn't. I was looking to see if your organization was in the room.
I know with some interest
right
that they're that they're not in the room at the present time. But there are a couple of things in this that bother me, and I think Senator Whitsitt has raised one of the questions or one of the issues. That is, at least in his case, in the private sector, in many of the cases in the private sector, the individuals have to assume some responsibility in their retirement planning. It is their responsibility. And one of the things I think that the organizations could do in the very early days of employment in these organizations, in their membership in these organizations, is to start pointing out how important retirement planning is, and for people to be active in this process. The place I think that you get most of your questions, and I don't know this because I don't have a study to verify it, is in those cases where people begin their retirement planning, 6 weeks before they want to retire, or before something comes along that makes them think they want to retire. Now, I know we got a flood of retirees a few years ago because of some changes that were happening in, with people who hadn't taken time to think about. And they probably had a whole myriad of questions that probably they wouldn't have had if they'd have started thinking about all of these variables before. In my good friends here cases, knowing that they're all out there by themselves, they have to start thinking about it earlier. Or suffer the consequences for not having thought about it earlier. I do believe that some of the organizations, OEA, AFSCME, OSEA, et al., SEIU, have a responsibility to their members, maybe to begin emphasizing some of this process early on. I think it's a fairly legitimate case. A member benefit, such as buying an automobile for more money than it would cost me if I went down and bought it myself from an agency without going through the member benefits, maybe it'd be well if they spent the time and energy on something that, and this is a kind of... And I have no familiarity with the member benefits of Ms. Botkin's group, so I can't speak to that. But I think this is probably a fairly good idea to pursue or to elaborate on. I have problems, and I come out of the public sector in the main, and I have problems for wanting to, or the tendency of us to want to to remove them, the individuals, from the responsibility of doing their own planning or participating in their own planning, and then expecting at that day to suddenly have somebody there that's going to explain all of the ins and outs and whatever it happens to be for them. That's somewhat dangerous, I suppose, for me to say, on the record, since this is all a, political issue that we're dealing with here, but there's also a situation of how much of our plan do we want to devote to these kind of services at the expense, ultimately, of what is going to be the most important service they have, and that is paying our retirement checks to the maximum that we're entitled to on time, and all of those kind of trivial little things so that we can pay our rent bills and thing. I think another issue is complicating this, and I think we need to consider that when PERS was
you know, first thought of, we didn't really probably conceptualize that we were going to have people retiring in their 50s, and in some cases in their 40s. That the thought of retirement was, 65, or if you were somehow or another real lucky, maybe 62. And we've changed that whole scenario now in recent years, and it's added much of a new dimension to everything. And I don't know how that all plays into this. So I'd be kind of interested in little sidebar discussions and on your parts to... Yeah. Maybe bring us some other information on it at another point. And if you haven't surmised, it may be important to do that if you're to get the support on the, from everybody that you may want to have to look at or try to move this issue forward.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments, and I've learned long ago that an agency can't provide everything on its own. It's got to work in partnership with the private sector. It's got to work in partnership with its stakeholder groups. Yeah. It can fill some gaps. It's got to put sideboards around it. But we'll keep that in mind and bring you back some example of how we work in partnership with everybody.
And I'm sorry, members, I didn't mean to go into a tirade on this issue, but
Well, you're the chair, you can do that.
I know. That's what this is all about. We're here.